Okay, we're recording. Good, so for the third lecture on statistical methods, I want to talk about multivariate methods. So the idea here is to select events as belonging to a certain type, and I want to examine this event selection process from the standpoint of a statistical test. Right? And so there are certain important theorems, actually, that say how to do that event selection task in an absolutely optimal way. And unfortunately, these theorems then turn out to be of less actual use in practice, but it's nevertheless interesting to see. And then I want to run through quickly some multivariate classifiers, some of which I think you may have heard about, others not. Neural networks, I think, are quite commonly used. Boosted decision trees have become remarkably popular, for reasons I'm not sure I completely understand. There's something else called a support vector machine, which has very interesting mathematics behind it and has not really taken off in particle physics yet. I have way too much material in this lecture, and so I think that I will probably skip the lecture, the material. Freudian slip there. I will skip the material on support vector machines, but I will cover the rest of the lecture. So here's just a brief list of some resources on multivariate methods. Here's some books. And in particular, I like this big, thick book by Bishop, Pattern Recognition and Machine Learning. It's really, I would say, an advanced undergraduate textbook on machine learning. So it's the kind of thing that I think a physicist can pretty much pick up and understand. The rest of these are, well, in particular, the one by Hastie et al. is quite authoritative, but I think also very challenging to read. There have been some other meetings where particle physicists have gotten together and discussed multivariate methods. There's this FISTAT series, of course, is not just about multivariate methods. It's been about all sorts of statistical questions related to particle physics. But if you look at the proceedings of those, there is a lot of interesting information. There's a workshop at Caltech, some slide lectures, various things you can take a look at. Software for multivariate methods. There is this program called TMVA. So MVA stands for multivariate analysis, and the T is because every class in the root package has to start with the letter T. And so this is a package which is bundled together with root, although it has its own sort of a website. And it is basically a software framework that allows you to use a wide variety of multivariate classifiers. And one of the nice things I like about this package is that the user's guide, the manual, it not only tells you how to run the software, but it explains really very clearly the mathematics behind what you're doing. So you don't have to simply look at these classifiers as black boxes. You can really understand what they're doing. During the whole time when TMVA was being developed, there was another program being developed by my colleague Ilya Narski at Slack. And then they were really complementary in a way and sort of competitors. And unfortunately, about a year ago, Ilya seems to have left particle physics. So I think now TMVA is really the package of choice. Okay, so now let me just motivate the main idea of what we need to talk about for multivariate analysis. We record events. Each event is characterized by various observable quantities. So this is a simulated SUSY event, right? You've got some high PT leptons, you've got high PT jets, you've got missing transverse energy, and all of those quantities will follow some multivariate joint distribution in some high-dimensional space, depending on how many quantities you actually write down for each event. And so that's what we would like to identify. We would like to establish whether or not events with those characteristics are present in the data sample. Right? Unfortunately, of course, there are other events from standard model processes, background processes, which share very similar characteristics. So that's a simulated TT bar event, just a standard model event. It also has high PT leptons. It also has jets. Because of the neutrinos, there's also missing ET. And so events of this type can easily mimic a SUSY event. And so the whole conversation revolves about how can we separate the events of the type we're interested in, the signal, from those, from the rest, the background. Now, what we have for essentially every background type that we're interested in is a Monte Carlo generator, which will simulate events of that specific type. Right, so we can run Pythia, and we can request it to produce, you know, proton, proton goes to gluino, gluino, or whatever. So for any given event type, what we have at our disposal, usually, is an event generator. Okay, and so an event in this context just means a list of numbers, a list of the four momenta of every particle produced. So in principle, the number of quantities that you could use to characterize every event is basically every number that gets spit out by the Monte Carlo generator. Now, in practice, of course, you don't use the momentum vector of every single particle, but rather you form jets, you identify leptons, and so forth. So, but in principle, we have a large number of measurable quantities available for every event. Okay, so now let me address this question of event selection seen as a statistical test. The idea is for every event, you measure some set of numbers, and I'll write that as this vector x with n components. But the components of the vector could be completely different things. The first component could be some jet PT, the second component could be a missing energy, the third component could be some, you know, some BTAG measure or something like that. So the different numbers just represent different characteristics measured for the event. This vector x will follow some n-dimensional joint probability density, which depends on the type of event in question. For example, was it a TT bar event, was it a gluino event, or what have you. And so, it's just symbolically here, I represent two of the dimensions, xi versus xj. You can imagine that for one of the event types, the events might be distributed like that, and for another, like that. And I'll use this notation, p of x given, and then I'll put a label for the hypothesis in question. So I could write H0 and H1 just as labels for the event types. Or I might use, for example, S and B for signal and background. Right? But those are just labels for the event types. Oops, what happened? There we go. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to find a decision boundary in this n-dimensional space, of which I'm only showing two dimensions, that will separate those classes of events. And the typical way people start out is simply by making cuts on the available variables. And what that boils down to in this context is saying that I have a rectangular decision boundary. And you can see that would do a pretty good job here. But in other circumstances, perhaps a rectangular boundary wouldn't be the optimal boundary between the classes. Perhaps some sort of linear boundary, effectively a hyperplane in this n-dimensional space, could be better. Now, actually, if you look at the way these points are distributed, there's sort of a banana-like structure there. And you can think that perhaps a curved boundary, some sort of nonlinear decision boundary, would give you a better separation between the event classes. And so the whole discussion of multivariate methods really boils down to what is the optimal decision boundary, what is the functional form of the of that red line. Right. Okay, so now that surface in that n-dimensional space can be described by a function of the form y of x equals constant. So some function of x equals constant, that's a surface in that n-dimensional space. And so that's what I need to find. I need to find the function that gives me that surface. Alternatively, or equivalently, I can view that function as a scalar test variable, a discriminating variable. That is to say, once I've defined what that function is, I can treat it as a random variable. I observe events. For each event, I get a vector x. I evaluate that function y of x for each event, and I look at how it's distributed. And what you would find is that for events of one type, it would follow some distribution like that. And for events of the other type, it would hopefully follow a distribution that would be separated. Right? So this decision boundary in the n-dimensional space is now reduced to a simple cut on the scalar variable y, which is the variable that defines that the decision boundary. Right? So that effectively, that single cut now in this new quantity y of x effectively divides the x space into these two regions where you either accept or reject one or the other hypothesis. Right? So, now, how do you find the optimal test statistic, the optimal function y of x? Well, it turns out that there is an optimal answer, and that is what's given by this theorem called the Neyman-Pearson lemma. And what it states is that to obtain the highest background rejection, which means the lowest background efficiency, for a given signal efficiency, what the statisticians would say, it's the highest power for a given significance level test. Right? But that boils down to saying highest background rejection for a given signal efficiency. Then you should choose the acceptance region, the thing enclosed by that decision boundary, such that everywhere inside the acceptance region, that ratio is higher than it is outside the region. So that ratio is the probability for the observables, x, given the one hypothesis, which I've labeled here as signal, divided by the corresponding probability density for the other hypothesis, which I've called here background. All right. Now, what the value of that constant is, where it's bigger than that constant inside the acceptance region, or smaller than the constant outside the acceptance region, what you choose that constant to be is what determines the signal efficiency. You can imagine these decision boundaries here. Oops. These decision boundaries are really sort of a family of curves. I mean, I could have one like that, then I could, if I set y of x equal to a different constant, it would just move the curve over. So the actual value of the constant that you choose is what will determine effectively the signal efficiency. Now, equivalently, what you can say is you can take this ratio of probability densities, which is called the likelihood ratio, and that is what gives you your optimal test variable to discriminate between the two hypotheses. So you could accept events by saying, I require that y of x be less than some cut value, y cut. Right?
Price of c is worse than
Sorry?
The choice of c is worse than everyone chooses.
Well, okay, so no. It it will depend on the analysis, and it will determine effectively what your signal efficiency is. Now, there will be a trade-off basically between the signal efficiency and the purity of your sample. All right, and you can imagine that if you need a very pure sample, then you would make a very tight selection, and that would give you a low signal efficiency, but you would get a very pure sample of signal events. On the other hand, maybe you have not much data, so you need to have a higher signal efficiency, and you're willing to put up with somehow more background in your sample. Now, depending on the goal of the analysis, there can be an optimal trade-off between the purity and the efficiency. For example, if you want to measure the signal rate, you can show that you want to choose the signal efficiency so as to maximize the amount of signal divided by the square root of signal plus background. Right? If you're doing a search for the signal process, then the optimum is a little bit different. But so depending on the goals of the analysis, you have to strike some balance between the signal efficiency and signal purity. That's right. Okay. So, but we have this, the hard part though, let me shove that problem aside and just concentrate on how to try to establish the function y of x. All right. Now, if I make a cut that says y of x less than y cut, then clearly y of x squared is less than y cut squared, or log of y of x is less than log of y cut. If I have any monotonic function of this test variable, it would be just as good. All right? It would give me effectively the same test. And I want to mention that because sometimes we will see test variables that are not given by the likelihood ratio, but they're given by something which is a monotonic function of that. Okay, so that's interesting. We have this theorem which tells us how to solve our problem. It tells us exactly what that test statistic should be. Why don't we just use it and then end the discussion and go home? The problem is that we usually do not have explicit formulas for the probability densities that you need in the numerator and denominator of the likelihood ratio. That is to say, for any given point in x space, I don't have a formula that would allow me to evaluate p of x given signal or p of x given background. All right. What you have instead are Monte Carlo models. For each process, you have a complicated computer program which allows you to sample instances of x for the signal process. And you can generate instances of x for the background process. Those are your events. But for a given x, I can't tell you what p of x would be, right? Because I don't have the formula. So what you could think you might do is you say, all right, I will just I'll just make a histogram. Suppose I consider the case where the vector x is just a one-dimensional thing. And so for my... That's not dark enough. So for my signal process, I might have some histogram like that. And then for my background process, I would have some histogram, which would hopefully be in a different place. And so for a given value of x that I'm interested in, I could say, well, that's approximately the value of the density for the signal process, and I divide by that value for the background process. And so in the limit that I have lots of events and very small bins, you can see that that would work. That would give me the appropriate ratio. On the other hand, if you have a higher dimensional problem, so let's add a dimension to each of these. So you can imagine that instead of just a one-dimensional histogram, this becomes some sort of a curve in a two-dimensional space. And over here I have some surface in this two-dimensional space. But I make these two-dimensional histograms, so I have some cell in this space here, and I have to divide by the corresponding cell over here. As the number of dimensions increases, the number of cells in the n-dimensional space grows exponentially with the number of dimensions. And so the number of events that you would have to generate in order to populate every cell of that space can become prohibitively large. You can imagine that if you had an n-dimensional histogram and you used, say, m bins for each of the n dimensions, then that would give you m to the n cells. And furthermore, the densities might be such that, for some of the cells, maybe the density is very, very low. And so there's just no way. Very quickly, when you try to go to higher dimensions, just trying to estimate the densities with an n-dimensional histogram is a losing proposition. So the idea is to come up with some other ansatz that will allow you to write down some functional form for this test variable which has fewer parameters to determine, fewer than m to the n. All right? And then to try to determine those parameters in such a way as to achieve the maximal separation between signal and background. Okay, so I want to mention that there are really two distinct event selection problems that we have to deal with. In one case, both types of events are known to exist. So, for example, TT-bar production in hadron collisions is an established process, and we will be doing this at the LHC in order to select TT-bar events so as to measure the properties of the top quark. We want to measure its mass and couplings and so forth. More commonly, however, the signal process is a process that corresponds to some theory beyond the standard model whose existence is not yet well established. And the whole goal of the analysis is to see whether or not there is evidence in the data of the presence of that process. All right? So in this second case, the null hypothesis means standard model events, and this alternative hypothesis means events of a type whose existence is not yet established. So, as we discussed yesterday, the way to quantify the significance of such a discovery will be to compute a p-value and to require that p-value be below some threshold. Here's roughly the picture to keep in mind, is that if you look at the expected distributions of this test statistic y, it might look like that for background and like that for signal. But of course, these are the probability densities. These are both normalized to unit area. The actual number of background events is probably going to be much greater than the number of signal events. The number of signal events may turn out to be zero. Right? But what you would be looking at in such an analysis would be, you would be looking for an excess of events in this area over on the right-hand side where you expect the signal events to lie. So you would be looking you would define some search region and you would look for an excess there. Alternatively, if you could really trust these shapes, you could actually do a fit to the full distribution based on the shapes expected for each of the two components. Now, the point I wanted to make here is the following. Let's suppose we do it in the following way. We define a search region, and I count the number of events I see in the search region. Perhaps by integrating the background distribution there, I would find a certain expected number of background events, whatever, 4.6 expected background events. And then I count the number of signal of total events that I see there, and you know, it's some number 8 or 9. And then I want to know what is the significance of that excess that I have observed. So that means I would need to know the p-value, which is the probability to see, say, 9 events or more, given that the background is expected to contribute 4.6. That would be my p-value that I would quote to quantify the significance of my discovery. Now, obviously, if that expected number of a background events were incorrect, then that could lead to a false discovery. All right, that is to say, if you misestimated the number of background events because you got the shape of this background distribution wrong, you could trick yourself into thinking that you saw a discovery. So knowing the shape of the background distribution, especially as it extrapolates into the signal region, is crucial. It's very important to be able to understand the shape of the background distribution. Okay, so I have to look at the clock here. What I want to do is to mention briefly some of the standard multivariate methods, and then to go into somewhat more detail about just a couple of the, what I'll call, non-standard methods. So I'm going to make some comments on placing cuts, linear discriminants. I'll make a few comments on neural networks. And I guess I don't have any comments on this, so I'm just going to say what I mean here. There's a class of methods called probability density estimation methods. And the idea is the following. I argued that the optimal test variable would be given by the ratio of these two densities, P of X given signal divided by P of X given background. Well, all right, I may not have explicit formulas for these two densities, but I can try to estimate them in some way, perhaps not with histograms, but with some more slightly more sophisticated method. Right? And then I could call those estimates P hat of X given S and P hat of X given B. And then I can use the ratio of those two approximate probability densities to form the test variable. And that is certainly a very productive approach, and people do this, and there are a number of ways of trying to estimate these densities. Okay, so I just wanted to make the comment that method exists. In principle, it's the best if you can get an accurate estimate of the densities, and that just becomes more and more difficult as the dimension of the data vector increases. Okay, but for the other three, I'm just going to make some brief comments. Let me make a comment on a cut-based study, which I think illustrates the success of a cut-based study. And so I don't know if this has been discussed earlier in the school, probably, that in the 1990s, CDF, I apologize for the very elementary nature of this slide. It was being shown to a bunch of astronomers a couple weeks ago, so I had to show them what a detector looked like and everything. But what they measured was the inclusive jet rate as a function of the transverse energy. And so this was a fantastic agreement between the data points and the QCD prediction over many orders of magnitude. But the prediction was low relative to the data at the very high ET end. Right? Now, if you look at the data minus theory divided by theory, you can see that for very large jet ET, oh, my scale fell. This is the ET and GEV, all right, that the data points lie significantly above this line. And so the test variable, effectively, in this case, is the jet ET. Right? And the fact that that test variable is a physical quantity for which the physicists have some intuition, people were able to, therefore, come up with a plausible explanation for what could be causing this discrepancy. Right? And in fact, one of the first explanations that people thought of was that if quarks possessed some internal substructure, then this is exactly what you would expect. You would expect to see a higher jet rate at a very high ET. And this would not, the ability to see that physics behind it would not have been possible if this variable, instead of being jet ET, had been some neural network output or some complicated test variable that was a complicated combination of many different components of this data vector. Right. Now, in fact, the fact that this was a physical variable, which people understood at some level, allowed people to propose other possible explanations. And in fact, it was proposed that if you tweaked the parton densities that you could also explain away this discrepancy. And that was at least one of the explanations that was proposed and I believe more or less accepted. Now, I show this because I regard this as a success of the cut-based approach. Right? The physical understanding of the output variable led to the solution of an apparent discrepancy. Okay, so that was the comment that I wanted to make on the cut-based method. Okay, now I just have a couple comments on linear decision boundaries. So you can imagine that you have this n-dimensional space, and I'm going to take as my decision boundary a hyperplane in that space. And it turns out that there are some problems for which that is the optimal solution. If both densities are multivariate Gaussian distributions with equal covariance matrices, but different mean values, so this one's centered there and that one's centered there, then it turns out for that specific problem, the linear decision boundary is equivalent to using the likelihood ratio. All right? They're related by a monotonic relation. On the other hand, for some other problems like that, you can easily imagine that there are many problems for which a linear decision boundary is almost useless. Right? If you had something like that, you could try drawing a single line that gives you an effective separation between the red triangles and the blue dots. It doesn't work very well. On the other hand, there clearly is an obvious decision boundary that one could use. And one of the tricks that is often employed is to try to transform the original variables to some transformed set of variables, such that for the transformed set of variables, you would get a better separation by using a linear decision boundary. And so here you can just kind of see it. You can see, well, all right, the separation has something to do with the radius from the origin. So I'll take as one of my transformed variables the radius, all right, square root of x1 squared plus x2 squared. And clearly there's some sort of dependence on the angle as well. And so I'll take one of the variables to be effectively the angle of the point, relative to, say, the x1 axis. And if you transform the x space to this phi space, then that's what the points then look like. All right? Very often in this context, such a transformation is the phi space is called the feature space. Right? And in this feature space, then a linear decision boundary works quite well. So that's a very commonly used approach that although you may think that in your original space, a linear decision boundary is basically useless, perhaps with some clever transformation, you can make it such that a linear transformation gives you much better performance.
Right.
Well, even here, it's not optimal. It's not going to be perfectly optimal. Right? Does it work all the time? All right, hang on. I think that I'm going to take that back slightly. A simple transformation of the type that I have thought up here is not going to work all the time. All right? But I'm going to come back to that point when I discuss neural networks, that depending on how you set up this transformation to the feature space, if you include enough adjustable parameters in this transformation, you will be able to approximate the optimal decision boundary arbitrarily well. Now, in this particular case, there were no adjustable parameters in this transformation. I simply said phi1 is the angle, phi2 is the radius. Right? But you can imagine a situation where I had some adjustable parameters in the transformation, and I tried to choose the values of those parameters so as to establish the best separation. Right? That's what's coming up. And if you do that, then yes, given enough parameters, you will be able to approximate arbitrarily well the optimal decision boundary. Okay, so here it is. All right, here's a way to do it. It's by using neural networks. So the idea behind a neural network is quite simple. It's most easily explained with a diagram of this sort. Suppose we start with our input variables here, and I'll draw a node for each of the input variables, x1 through xn. And then, effectively, I'm going to make a transformation to a feature space. And I will call the transformed variables h1 through hm. Doesn't have to be the same number. And I will draw a node for each of the transformed variables, and they form what is called the hidden layer of this network. And to get the transformation for a particular node in the hidden layer, I do the following. I take a linear combination of the input variables. All right, so this is just a linear combination of the input variables xj And these weights there are adjustable parameters. And I also usually include a constant offset as well. All right, so the WI0 and the WIJ are all adjustable parameters that give me the value of the node, the ith node, in this hidden layer. So these could be, in my previous notation, that would have been phi1 through phi something. Here, I've called it H. Right? But what I do is I take that linear combination and I use it as the argument to a nonlinear function, a nonlinear activation function. And usually the activation function is taken to be something like this here. This is an example of a sigmoid function. All right? It's basically 0 for very negative, and then it goes up to 1, and it has some continuous turn on. All right? So that gives you your first transformation, that your hidden layer. And then for the final output, you can do this a similar thing. You can say that the value of the classifier, I've called it here T of X, but that's what I called before Y of X. I take a linear combination of the values in the hidden layer, and I use those as the argument for the same nonlinear activation function. Now, you can obviously generalize that to an arbitrary number of hidden layers, and you can have an arbitrary number of nodes in the hidden layers. There is a theorem which says that with a single hidden layer, but with a sufficiently large number of nodes, that such a neural network can approximate arbitrarily well the optimal decision boundary. So that's the answer to the question there. Yes? It doesn't have to be, but in the applications that I've seen in particle physics, it almost always is. All right? Sometimes there can be a temperature parameter which effectively regulates the sharpness of that transition. But that is equivalent, more or less, to a rescaling of the variables. So I think in the applications that I've seen in particle physics, people always use the same activation function. Of course, you can imagine that the whole vocabulary of neural networks gives away that these were designed to model neurological processes. And these coefficients are sometimes called synapse strengths, and the training, the adjusting of the coefficients is called learning, and so forth. So in neurological applications, I can imagine that it might make sense to use different activation functions. Because presumably in your brain, to the extent that this is an accurate model, that might be more accurate. Okay. Right. Do I have an example of that? Yes. Right. So here's a nice example. One of the things that we were doing at LEP, in the latter portion of the LEP program, when the energy was increased above the threshold to produce W pairs, is that we wanted to select these events of the type E plus E minus goes to WW in order to study the W properties and measure the W mass and so forth. Now, the W, of course, can decay in a number of different ways, but one of the common ways is into two jets. And so if both W's decay to jets, then you get four fairly well-separated hadron jets. But that's not the only way to produce a four-jet event in E plus E minus. You could get E plus E minus goes to QQ bar with then two additional gluons being radiated. But then on average, the gluon tends to have a slightly smaller angle relative to one of the quarks. And so there is some way to distinguish between these two, at least statistically. And so here are distributions of a number of the variables that were used to try to distinguish between the WW events and this particular background. And so I don't know if this is the kind of thing that you have dealt with in this school. I mean, a lot of you probably haven't done E plus E minus experiments, so I don't know if you know about things like thrust and sphericity and planarity. But you can kind of guess that they have to do with the shape of the event, whether or not it's somehow planar or spherical or jet-like or what have you. And you can see that for any one of these variables, the separation between the two classes of events, the WW or the yellow ones and the open histogram is the QQ bar GG, that for any one of those variables, you don't get a very good separation between the classes. But if you use those nine events as the inputs to a neural network, then the distribution of the network output gives you a much better separation. Okay? Right. So let me make some comments on use of neural networks, but really I think these comments are applicable to any of the classifiers that we would consider. Now, in the example with these WW events, the goal was to select the events so as to study later the properties of the W boson. And so you can imagine one of the properties we might maybe wanted to study was the average number of particles in a W decay. Right? On the other hand, we used certain variables as inputs that allowed that we thought would distinguish these WW events from the other types of events. And you can imagine that we might have used something like the average number of particles in the event as one of the input variables. Now, if you did so, and you used, you know, the Monte Carlo actually said, of course, that the W goes to two jets gives you less particles on average than a Z going to two jets. Suppose we used the number of particles then as one of our input variables and trained the neural network using those models. It would then have said, all right, if you see an event with fewer particles, it's most likely a WW event, so you should classify it that way. And we would have selected those events and given them to the next person doing the analysis, who would have said, all right, I now want to measure the number of particles in WW events, and you say, ah, it's less. So that would have just been a circular argument. And so the point is you need to avoid using input variables that are correlated with the properties that you eventually want to study. And that's not trivial, because to some level, at least through kinematics, almost everybody is correlated with everybody else. All right, so it can be a non-trivial problem to find a set of input variables that are completely decorrelated from the things that you eventually want to study. Let's see. This comment, I guess, I made, that the single layer with a sufficiently large number of nodes can approximate arbitrarily well the likelihood ratio. But so how do you choose the actual number of nodes? If you take a very, very large number of nodes, that means you have a large number of coefficients to determine. Now, the way you determine those coefficients is by using samples of training data from Monte Carlo. And those coefficients will be determined with some statistical accuracy. If you have a finite set of Monte Carlo data, then you will have larger statistical errors on those parameters. And if you choose too many hidden nodes, that means that the statistical errors will effectively be larger. Right? So typically what you do is you start with a relatively small number of nodes and you increase that one by one until your misclassification rate stops decreasing. Now, I'll make a comment in just a second on how to estimate that misclassification rate. You have one set of Monte Carlo data, signal and background, that you use to train the neural network. But then typically what you use is a statistically independent sample of Monte Carlo data in order to assess the performance of the network. And so let me actually just go straight to that point. Here is an example. This is actually not from a neural network, it's from a support vector machine, but this argument applies to any of the classifiers. You can imagine that if you include a very large number of parameters in the decision boundary, then that will allow a very, very high degree of flexibility in the decision boundary. And in this particular case, I've inserted so many parameters that I get an absolutely perfect classification between the blue dots and the red triangles. I like that one, right? It gets it perfectly. On the other hand, if you were then to take that exact decision boundary and to apply it to a statistically independent sample of events, well, then there's no reason to believe that such structures like that are going to do the job of actually separating the blue from the red. And you can see here it doesn't work. All right? So this is an example of what is called overtraining. The coefficients have been tuned to basically pass around all the data points, but this performance does not generalize when you apply that boundary to a statistically independent sample. So what you always do is you measure the misclassification rate using an independent sample. If you look, for example, at the error rate as a function of the number of parameters in the classifier, you'll find that the misclassification rate will start to decrease for both as you increase the number of parameters. But then for the training sample, it will continue to decrease and eventually give you perfect separation, whereas for the independent test sample, at some point it will stop decreasing. And that is, it can be used to tell you where to stop, how many hidden nodes, say, to put into the neural network. I'm going to come back to that point when we get to boosted decision trees. So. Okay, right, which we're essentially at now. So I now want, those were the sort of standard classifiers that I wanted to mention. So cuts, linear, neural networks. For many years, I think neural networks were the only sort of advanced method used by particle physicists. But a few years ago, boosted decision trees started to become popular, and now people use them all the time. And I ask myself as to whether people really understand what's in them. So I want to discuss what a boosted decision tree is all about. And one of the first applications of boosted decision trees was done by the Mini-Boon experiment at Fermilab. And this was a big tank of mineral oil, a 12-meter diameter tank of mineral oil, and it was exposed to a beam of muon-type neutrinos, all right? And you were looking for appearance of nu e, all right? So as to give evidence for a nu mu to nu e oscillations. And so what you had on the outer edge of this tank of mineral oil is a 1,500 photomultiplier tubes. And depending on the type of interaction, you would get a different pattern of hits in these photomultiplier tubes. So if you had a oscillation to nu e and that gave you an electron coming out, that would give you a single fuzzy ring, whereas if it was a muon, it would give you it would have more penetrating power, so it would give you a longer blob, and so forth. Okay, so from this, the pattern of hits in these photomultiplier tubes, you want to try to see if there's evidence for that class of events in the data sample. Okay, and that was done with a boosted decision tree. So first of all, let me describe an ordinary decision tree, not boosted. The way that works is the following, is that I'm going to assume that I can assign a weight to each of these events. Right? I will start by assigning equal weights to all events, but then later on there's going to be a rule which will adjust those weights. But I will assume that for every event, I can assign a weight, wi, such that the purity that I would say I get for the sample is the sum of the weights for the signal events divided by the sum of all of the weights. Right? Now I have some set of variables that I'm using to classify these events. There can be the number of PMT hits, some measure of the energy, some measure of the radius of the ring of Cherenkov light, and so forth. And so, to train this decision tree, I have to start with two samples of Monte Carlo events, signal and background. All right? And what I do is I look for the single variable which, with a single cut, gives me the best separation between signal and background. All right? And so, it so happened that in this analysis, that was the number of PMT hits. Right. And when you made that cut, let's see. So you start out with a sample which has, say, 52 signal events and 48 background events. And you find that if you make a single cut on the number of PMT hits at 100, then that gives you the best improvement in the purity based on that formula for the purity. Right? And so what you find over here is that it gives you then, if you have greater than 100 PMT hits, that gives you 48 signal events and 11 background. And over here, it gives you 4 signal and 37 background. Right? Now, if the purity that you achieve exceeds a certain threshold, then what you would do is you would stop here. You would say, all right, fine. I will call that is what's called a leaf in the tree. All right. Whereas here you say that the purity hasn't really improved that much, and so I'll go further. I'll look then amongst the rest of the variables and see which one, with a single cut, gives me the best improvement in the purity. All right, and it turned out to be some energy measure. And that gave you here, on this side, 9 signal and 10 background, and here, 39 signal and 1 background. So there you stop, and here you keep on going. All right? So you keep on searching at each stage for the single variable which gives you the best improvement with a single cut. And then the stop criterion is based on either exceeding a certain purity or if the number of events in a given node falls below some threshold. Okay, so you iterate this procedure until the stop criterion is reached. And that final set of cuts basically defines the decision boundary. Right? And that is what's called a decision tree. And decision trees in that form, in fact, have been around for many years, at least many decades, I think. And they classify basically every point in this input variable space as either being in a signal region or a background region. So we can define a numerical function. So f of x equal to 1 if x is in the signal region, or minus 1 if it's in the background region. Okay, that gives us a numerical function to deal with. Now, the reason that decision trees by themselves have not been widely used in analyses of this sort is that they are very sensitive to statistical fluctuations in the training samples. And you can easily see how that might come about, because suppose that two of the variables have a very similar level of discriminating power. Right, so PMT hits an energy. Suppose they both have roughly the same level of discriminating power. I searched for the variable which gave me the best improvement with a single cut. And maybe with one training sample, that was the PMT hits. But if I were to generate a second statistically independent sample, maybe it would have been a different variable. Maybe it would have been the energy. But whatever variable you pick for that first variable, that influences the structure of the remainder of the tree. All right, so if you had a different variable chosen for the first splitting variable, the structure of the tree would be completely different, and you would get a very different looking decision boundary. All right. The big innovation just a few years ago was this, maybe already 10 years ago, say, was this procedure known as boosting. And that is a procedure which can be used to stabilize the tree. It is a general method which can be used to create a classifier which is less sensitive to statistical fluctuations in the training samples. And furthermore, it can have a smaller error than any than an individual classifier, than an individual decision tree. So like I say, it's often applied to decision trees, but it's a general procedure. It can be applied to any classifier. You could do it with a neural network. But it's very often applied to decision trees exactly because decision trees have this high sensitivity to statistical fluctuations. So the way boosting works is the following. Let me suppose that I start with some training sample of events, which I'll denote by T. It consists of n events, so that means n instances of this data vector. Okay, each x is some multivariate object. And then I have the true class labels for each. Okay, so I know for each event if that was a signal event or a background event. Okay. And then I'm going to have event weights, W1 through WN, for each event. I'm going to start with them all equal. Okay. Now the idea is, given that, to define a rule to create from that training sample a set of an ensemble of pseudo-training samples to get a classifier trained on each of these pseudo-training samples and then effectively to average them. Okay. So there are a number of boosting algorithms on the market, but one of the first one, I think it might have been the first one, well, it's certainly one which has been used quite widely in particle physics, is this AdaBoost algorithm from Freund and Shapira. So I guess it is more than 10 years ago now. The way it works is, I think, illustrative of all of them. They don't differ fundamentally in their philosophy. So let me explain the AdaBoost algorithm. Okay? So we have the event data vectors, the true class labels, and for these event weights, I'll take them all equal in the first instance, and I will normalize them such that the sum of the weights is equal to 1. Right? And this superscript here, 1, refers to the iterative step. So this is for training sample 1. Right? And then what you do is you take that training sample and you train your classifier. So you could train your decision tree, or if it was being applied to a different classifier, you would train that classifier. And that gives you what I'll call F1 of X. All right, that's the classifier that is, you know, plus 1 if you're in the signal region, minus 1 if X is in the background region. All right? And so here I've said, you know, train the classifier so as to minimize the classification error rate. So epsilon 1 here is the fraction of events that are incorrectly classified by this classifier. This formula here is just a complicated way of writing that. It's the sum over all of the events of the weight times a function which is 1 if the event was misclassified and 0 otherwise. You can see that yi is the true class label. It's plus 1 or minus 1. and then the product of the true class label and the classifier function, if that's negative, that means that they have the opposite sign, and that means that the event was misclassified. Okay. Right. Okay. So then what you do is you... I'm going to do this iteratively. So then for the kth step, I would define a score based on this error rate. And in the AdaBoost algorithm, this is just given by this formula. So it's a number which is high if the error rate is small. Okay? Now what I need, of course, to do this iteratively is to have a rule which tells me how to get from the kth training sample to the k plus 1 training sample. And the way you do that is by updating the weights. And the rule for updating the weights is the following. You say that the weight for the ith event at training sample k plus 1 is equal to the weight at step k times this factor. And if you look at this factor, it's e to the minus alpha k fk of xi yi over 2. Right? Here's the trick. Notice that here I have the product of the classifier times the true class label. Right? If the event is correctly classified, then that product is either plus 1 times plus 1 or minus 1 times minus 1. So it's positive. Right? So that means that if the event is correctly classified, then the weight gets multiplied by something e to the minus something positive. So it means that the weight decreases. On the other hand, if the event is incorrectly classified, then I get a plus times a minus, and that means the weight is increased. This thing in the denominator, that just renormalizes all of the weights so that the sum is still equal to 1. All right, so the important point being, you adjust the weights such that the incorrectly classified events get their weights bumped up a bit. So it says that in the next round, in the next iteration, the classifier should pay more attention to those misclassified events and try to bend it in such a way as to get them correctly classified. So you do that for every step, and so for every step I would get a classifier f sub k, and you iterate capital K times, and you define the final classifier as a weighted average of the individual classifiers. So here is a boosted decision tree example. Well, so this is the example from Miniboon. This is a complicated plot, and I just want to actually make one point here. The red dots and also the black show the error rate for the individual classifiers at each step. So the error rate that you would get from the fk of x for each k. Right? And what you see is that this error rate, the misclassification rate, is only a little bit less than 0.5. Well, if you think about it, 0.5, that's random guessing. That's just tossing a coin. And so each individual classifier by itself is relatively weak. But what they get out of this is, for the final classifier, in fact, is much better than just random guessing. Here... So on the left-hand side here, what I have is the... So what these plots show are the distribution of the classifier output after a certain number of steps. All right, so here's after one step, 100, 500, 1,000. And the red is the for signal, and the black dashed is for the background. And so you can see that if you just have one decision tree generated in this ensemble, that you get some number at plus 1 and some number at minus 1. All right, so that's just from a single decision tree. All right, but if you generate an ensemble of 100 decision trees, right, that's sometimes called a forest of decision trees, then the final averaged output will have distributions like this, and so you get what looks like an improving separation between the classes. And as you continue on to, say, 500 trees or 1,000 trees, eventually you get a perfect separation between the signal and background events. So this is exactly what I showed earlier with this overtraining. Right? What's happening here is that you're inserting so much flexibility into the decision boundary that it is conforming exactly to every event in the training sample. On the other hand, if you took that decision boundary and applied it to a statistically independent sample of signal and background events, then of course the separation between them would not be as perfect. And so here is the corresponding set of distributions for independent sample, and in the beginning you get similar performance. All right, after 100 trees you get similar behavior, but here after 500 trees in the training sample the separation has become almost perfect, whereas when you apply that decision boundary to the test sample there's effectively no improvement. Right? And so that basically tells you where to stop. That tells you that it makes no sense to go beyond a couple hundred trees in the boosting algorithm. Okay. There are a number of boosting algorithms on the market. There's this AdaBoost. There's other ones called Epsilon Boost and Epsilon Hinge Boost and Logic Boost and various others. And the only thing, I just wanted to make the point that there are a number of different options available. And these different boosting algorithms differ primarily in the rule that they use for updating the weights. All right, so rather than having some sort of exponential factor, they might have some slightly different rule. And what these plots show is something like the background. It's 1 minus the background efficiency versus the signal efficiency. It's the ratio of the background to signal efficiency versus the signal efficiency. So it's just some measure of the performance. You would like this curve to be as far to the lower right as possible. So really the point I just wanted to make with that plot is that there are a number of different boosting algorithms on the market. Okay, so just here's some quick discussion on boosted decision trees. One of the advantages is that it can handle a very large number of input variables. And in the example by Miniboon, for every event, they had, I believe it was 200 input variables. Now normally if you use a very large number of input variables for, say, a neural network, that means that you would have a weight, a coefficient, for every input variable. And so the number of coefficients you would have to determine increases. And you run into problems with overtraining because you have lots of adjustable parameters. Now, in boosted decision trees, it's not so bad because if you have some variables that have perhaps only very little, provide only very little additional information, allowing you to discriminate between the event classes, then those variables will very rarely be chosen as the splitting variables, right? Because at every stage you look for the variable which with a single cut gives you the best discrimination. If you have included in your set of input variables, you know, the phase of the moon or the price of cheese or whatever, something that doesn't really tell you as to whether an event is a signal event or a background event, it will simply never be used as a splitting variable. And it goes along for the ride. It doesn't contribute any noise to the system. Until you would have, for example, because of a statistical fluctuation, suddenly one of these uninformative variables happens to appear to give you a large separation. And then if you use that variable as a splitting variable, that would be contributing effectively noise to the system. But boosted decision trees are relatively insensitive to using large numbers of inputs. I think that's one of the reasons why they've become popular. It's easy to deal with inputs of different types. They can be real or integer or even categorical variables like a color or something that's not ordered. Concerning how to visualize what comes out, if the tree only has a few leaves, if a single tree only has a few leaves, then basically the decision boundary is dictated by this set of cuts. And so you can say, well, that sounds nice. I could visualize that set of cuts. I can visualize the decision boundary. But the problem is that people rarely use a single decision tree. It really only makes sense to use it together with one of these boosting algorithms. And then the decision boundary becomes complicated again. I said there are a number of different boosting algorithms. And I should say also there are other ways of combining classifiers. There's something called bagging that you might run across. Bagging stands for bootstrap aggregating. And the basic idea is the same in that you generate an ensemble of training samples. The idea here is to basically you have your training sample of events. You take events from it randomly. And then you replace, and then you do that again. You randomly select events from your pool of training events. Each one of those gives you effectively a training sample, and you determine a classifier from each training sample and then average them. Okay, so I'm running out of time, so I just want to show a final example related to boosted decision trees. These were used in a recent analysis by both CDF and D0 looking for single top. So I don't know, has this been discussed in the last week? Because this is quite recent. As you know, I mean, top quarks can be produced, pair-produced, right, in hadron-hadron collisions, but you can also make them singly. right? If you have QQ bar goes to a W, goes to TB bar, you just get a single top. And if you're looking for that, then the pair-produced top events, that becomes a background. So this had been established for many years. This was mid-90s. And if you're looking for this, however, if you use some sort of discriminating variable that would allow you to find these guys, such as this HT is related to sums of PTs of jets in the system, you get contributions from various classes of events. It's the blue and the green is the contribution from single top. So you can imagine, suppose that you had, you know, your distribution is the data points, and you want to try to convince yourself, based on looking at the data, that you have a contribution from the blue and the green. I mean, that's pretty difficult. So by just looking at any one of these physically motivated variables, it would be very difficult. So people said, all right, we should use a multivariate a classifier. And here, they used absolutely everything in the book. So they used support vector machines and boosted decision trees and neural networks, something called a Bayesian neural network, which is effectively an average of neural networks. And so here is the output from the boosted decision tree. This is from D0, I guess, right? D0, yeah. And so here, the single top is supposed to be the blue sliver here on top. And if you zoom in on the right-hand edge, you can see that you're supposed to see some sort of excess from the single top production. And indeed, you do. And just this last year, when you take the boosted decision tree output and all of the others and use them as inputs to a new classifier and then use that finally to assess the significance, it exceeded the 5 sigma level. And so people said that was the discovery, finally, of single top. So first, let me make a couple comments on this adventure. First of all, single top is a standard model process that everybody kind of knew had to be there. So I don't really think it made a lot of sense to insist on this 5 sigma level to announce the discovery of the process. But nevertheless, people have somehow been trained in some Pavlovian sense to focus on this 5 sigma level, and so that was what was talked about. Second, remember that I said earlier that we had this example with the high ET jet anomaly, and because of the physical understanding we had of that variable, we were able to look at that and say, I can kind of understand what's causing these events to be high or low. Right? Whereas here I have a boosted decision tree output, which is a complicated function of a large number of input variables. So if I see some sort of behavior that I don't really understand here, it's not completely obvious to me how to propose an explanation for that discrepancy. Right? Now in this case, I think there was not a big controversy, exactly because single top is a process that everybody expected to see, and it came in at the expected rate. On the other hand, at the LHC, if we're trying to make the case for a more exotic signal, some sort of physics beyond the standard model, and if the case comes out like that, right, that we have some test variable, a boosted decision tree output or something else, and some sort of excess, but with maybe some sort of structure that doesn't quite look right, it's not obvious to me how the community is going to react, but there will definitely be a lot of discussion about, well, how, with such a variable, can you understand what's going on. So I'll come back to that point in just a second. Okay. Now, I'm out of time, so... Yeah. So the problem is that the data potentially just have a mixture of both event classes. All right, so that doesn't help you to train the network. You can imagine trying to construct some control sample of events where you think that only background should be present. And you can use that to basically to test your Monte Carlo for the background processes. All right? But if you actually want to determine the decision boundary so as to distinguish between these two classes, signal and background, then really you have to use a pure signal of a sample of signal events and a pure sample of background events. So that has to be Monte Carlo. Yeah. There are other cases where multivariate classifiers are used. So for example, for things like electron muon pion separation in calorimeters. All right? So you have some pattern of hits in a calorimeter that's characteristic of an electron that's different from if it's a pion. And so what you do is you put the calorimeter in a test beam of electrons. You put it in a test beam of pions. And so there you have a mechanism for producing, you know, pure data samples with real data. But in this context, I think we have to rely on the Monte Carlo machine. Yeah. But you can test, nevertheless, if you were then to go and say, take this and invert one of the cuts so as to reject signal, so that you think that you have primarily or almost all only background events. Then you could test the data, you could compare the data to the prediction of the classifier there and use that to tell you whether or not you think the background is being well modeled. Right. So let me finish up because I think we're short on time today. I have about 10 slides in the overheads on support vector machines. And I think that the mathematics of a support vector machine is incredible. It's fascinating. It's an example of making a transformation to a very high dimensional feature space and then using a hyperplane decision boundary in that high dimensional space. And the trick here is that you make this transformation in such a way that you only need scalar products between the feature space variables. And then there's a class of functions that can always be written in this way. And so it turns out that you don't even have to write down the transformation to the feature space variable explicitly. You only need this what's called the kernel function, which gives you the scalar product. And so I just invite you to take a look at those overheads on your own and to look at some of the references on your own. I think support vector machines have not been widely used in the community yet, but I'm not sure why not, because my friends in the machine learning community insist that they're better than neural networks. So I think we should take a look. All right. So I'll just skip over that and come to my conclusions. Right. Summary on how multivariate methods. Okay, so there are certain multivariate methods that we've been using for many years. Fisher discriminants, which is an example of a linear decision boundary, neural networks. I didn't talk about this naive Bayes method, but that's sometimes called the likelihood method. It's where you estimate the probability densities just by a product of marginal densities. In the last several years, we have started to use a few more, and in particular, these boosted decision trees have become quite popular. People use them all the time now. The important thing in this game is going to be on controlling systematic uncertainties between the training data and nature. That is to say that suppose your background Monte Carlo tells you that one of these distributions has some funny banana-like structure, and so you train your classifier so as to exploit that nonlinear structure. Well, it may be true that nonlinear structure is present in the Monte Carlo, but you have to ask yourself whether it's also there in the data. Right? Has that nonlinear structure ever been actually validated in the data? It is not sufficient to say that each of the projected distributions of each of the components agrees well between data and Monte Carlo. It's a question of these multivariate structures, the nonlinear structures. And it can be very difficult to assess whether or not those features have been validated with actual experimental information. Now, finally, let me get back to this point that I was making previously when I was sort of criticizing the single top analysis. Many of these classifier outputs are black boxes. If you see an enhancement somewhere, it can be difficult to know exactly what physics is driving that enhancement. Nevertheless, I think if we use sophisticated multivariate classifiers in searches for new phenomena, if you see something like a 5-sigma significance for some signal using one of these opaque methods, as long as that's backed up by, say, a cut-based analysis that may see also something, but perhaps not at 5-sigma level, maybe at 4-sigma level, then I think that is what will win the competition. All right, so I think Atlas would feel pretty stupid if we were conservative and said, well, we're not going to use boosted decision trees, we're just going to make cuts. And then CMS says, well, we're also going to make cuts, but then we also have a group of people using boosted decision trees and support vector machines. I think both approaches really should be tried. And if you see a signal in one but not in the other, well, then fine, then you have a mystery to resolve. But if both methods or a set of methods all point in the same direction, then that would increase your confidence. Okay, so I think that's the last thing we have. Yes, so I'll stop there.
You know exactly what to do sometimes. Okay.
It's a difficult argument, of course, because you know, we play this game with these advanced multivariate techniques, and it's clear that you know, at 4.9 sigma we cannot send our paper to GRL with the same observation because of that field effect. But
I think there we need need to overtrain the referees a little bit.
It's a community-wide issue, right? It's not something that we can say, oh, in one expression, we decide to. But coming back, if you want to go back a few slides to the output from the single top...
I know which one you mean.
So it's true that it's, in the end, you know, it's one can consider this to be a very shaky approach because you use multivariate tools in the different channels and another multivariate tool to the larger channels, right? So this is a sequence of a number of things, the booster decision trees going into booster decision trees. But there are good ways of calibrating these things because if you just look at the plot, then in that plot is the star.
Yes.
So you can just take exactly the same variables, retrain the thing, right? And measure, retrain the thing so that it goes towards TT bar, and measure the TT bar cross section, which you measure based on much simpler techniques in a sense in a different way. And you come out with the same answer.
Right.
That is, those are the things that you can do that allow you to calibrate these things and have confidence that they're not actually, you know, overestimating or underestimating your ability to see signals.
I think essentially is an example of what I was trying to say, and that is that you try to change the cuts so as to effectively select background events and then compare the data to the classifier's prediction for those background events. And you could do that for TT bar. You could try to isolate the other background components as well.
Well, in this case, the background component, you don't know the answer for WBB, WCC.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Fair enough.
You cannot use those, unfortunately. That's a problem, right? If you go into a signal, if you have the same thing, but TT bar was not a significant background, there is no way because you don't actually know the right answer.
One of the things that kind of struck me about this a little bit is that you can kind of imagine that there's some sort of structure here in the data which is different from the background prediction. I mean, that is a couple sigma low and that's a couple sigma high, and that's no big deal. But you know, what would you think if it was a little bit worse?
Glenn, you know, it's a dangerous game. Like, a posteriori saying, oh, one bin is low, the other bin is high, is a very dangerous game.
Well. It's nevertheless a game that people would play.
Because I can certainly take that data set and find a plot where I find a mass, but when I make invariant masses of all the things, I will find a bump in one thing.
Well,
I can guarantee you that.
Okay, but nevertheless, if you have decided a priori that this is the method that you're going to use to make the search, then that focuses your mind on a single distribution.
What?
And if the agreement between data and Monte Carlo, even with a mixture of signal and background, you know, doesn't look like if you don't get good agreement between data and Monte Carlo, it means that maybe you found something, but that something is not the signal that you think you were finding.
But Glenn, weren't you actually convinced by all the associated distribution plots which came?
Yes, exactly. Well, I was convinced by them, and I was convinced before I saw any plot, because I mean, it was pretty clear that nature was going to dish up single top at some rate, right? Namely, the predicted rate. Yes, but so that means that you can imagine if you made the cut on the ratio that your decision boundary would then be a diagonal line,
right,
in say y versus x. And so what's going to happen here is that it's going to be a series of rectangular boundaries which will eventually approach a diagonal line. Right. So that's the way that you would, your decision boundary is always a combination of these rectangular chunks. And to the extent that if what you need is something that moves at a diagonal, it's going to have to be a series of those diagonal chunks. Now, that's for a single decision tree. Once you boost it, then you can have a more complicated shape.
Yeah. I didn't really understand the usage of weights in the non-boosted decision tree.
No, in a non-boosted decision tree, you didn't need the weights. Yeah, sorry. The weights come into the boosting algorithm.
Match up pretty well with, you know, this, how good the variable is. For
seem to really be totally off. And is there any...
I'm not sure. So TMVA supplies a number of additional pieces of information that the user is invited to look at. And I've seen these, but I'm afraid I can't recall. It's nothing I really pay attention to. So I'm not sure. But that's either you can regard that as a good or a bad aspect of TMVA, that in addition to providing the facility to train and use the classifier, it provides a whole bunch of diagnostic tools. But these may not be the exact diagnostic tools that you are interested in using.
But this may come back to whether or not you have a legal problem. So usually those are performed with this principal components analysis at the beginning, and that gives you a linear.
Right.
You've got the log of the eigenvalues associated with them. And that it depends on your analysis, but that's the thing which is ultimately used to say whether or not one variable or the other is discriminating. But as Glenn showed, there are some spaces in which that's not the appropriate.
That's not a well thought through suggestion, but I think that is what I would suggest. Yeah. Right, that's sort of a context specific thing, but I think there are many types of analyses where it would be good to do a simple, robust analysis where you have some physical understanding for where you're placing the cut. Right? Because you understand that the variable is a jet energy, and as a physicist, you know that jet energy is below a certain range. Will come from certain types of processes or be well measured or poorly measured. Whereas if you just look at one of the coefficients in any of these classifiers, the more sophisticated classifiers, if I look at the connection strength in a neural network, I have no intuition for whether 7.235 is an appropriate value for that coefficient or not. So that would be the reason for also doing a cut-based analysis. But on the other hand, if you just think about the correlations, it's not just the correlations, by the way, I want to emphasize. It's the nonlinear, it's the banana-like structures. If you only had correlations, then you could just rotate the axis of axes of your input variables and then use a linear classifier. But it's these nonlinear structures which require the extra work. Yeah, I have to admit that I'm even any one of these methods with a sufficiently large number of adjustable parameters should be able to arbitrarily well approximate the optimal decision boundary. And so I have to admit I've never been I'm a bit of a skeptic of this procedure of combining, say, a neural network classifier with a boosted decision tree classifier in a new classifier. That seems to just make matters even more opaque. There, I don't know, maybe somebody in the audience can comment on that. I'm a skeptic of that approach.
Okay, let's leave it at that.
So let's assume we will find the Higgs in the next years, and it will be around 150 GeV. Now, if I remember it right, this would be the most boring point because our physics, particle physics model would be somehow complete. So we would all be depressed. And now you said that for this single top event, this is predicted by the standard model, so we believe in it, and we model it somehow that we now have these five sigma results. I mean, in the end, could this not be, because perhaps it's not true, and then this would be the gate to new physics.
I suppose, yes, in principle, if the production rate for single top had come in either less than or greater than the predicted standard model rate, you could argue that that was evidence for new physics. And you could make that sort of argument for almost any standard model process. I mean, if the rate is predicted and the observed rate is different, then of course that is a sign of new physics. I don't know, maybe some of the phenomenologists can comment, but I saw no particular reason to expect new physics from single top production. I don't know what's... What, the observation of single top, or the...
No, I don't see this high sigma level.
The five sigma level is not coming from this plot by itself. It's coming after you combine this with a number of other things. But I have to admit that I'm not completely satisfied. My gut feeling when I look at that is I don't say, there's obviously new, the blue component has to be there. I guess if you do the numbers carefully, you say yes. You can't explain the data without some of the blue component.
So we have to let Gustav have the last word.
Right, okay.
Well, the only addition I would like to make is that the book is not closed on Singletop, right? It came out with a total class action, which is very close to the standard model expectation. The reason to do Singletop is that it's a peculiar vertex where you hope to see new physics.
All right, so
the WTV vertex is a very interesting one, and Singletop is a sensitive bow to that. But the book is not closed. Unfortunately, I don't have it in my talk, but the interesting plot to make is you have two main